The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the second of our Guardian Haycasts. I'm Safraz Manzoor and you join me on a rather soggy Sunday from the Guardian's House of Hay studio in the very heart of the Hay Festival site. That noise you can hear in the background, by the way, is the rain lashing down on the roof. Joining me on the panel today to ensure that the wet weather doesn't rain on the Hay Parade are Christopher Hitchens, Naomi Klein and George Monbiot. And I suspect that the only thing that all three of them can agree on is that there isn't going to be much chance of topping up that tan today. To find out what the weather gods, if that's not too incendiary a phrase for Christopher, have in store, we can hear now from Hadley Freeman, the Guardian's deputy fashion editor, with her take on the weather forecast.
Sunday. Today we'll see light rain showers throughout Herefordshire.
Light rain showers. Well, it's the day that all of Great Britain has been waiting for. I am on stage. I think maybe flat boots to show stylishness but not scariness, worn over jeans for practicality, and then a little blouse so as to look not too scary. Even if Jeremy Paxman's in the audience, I feel sure he'll be awed by my Chloe riding boots.
Now, the weather's often cited as an obsession amongst the British. It's also a great leveller. I'm just wondering whether any of you feel like you're appropriately dressed. Christopher, you seem almost willfully inappropriately dressed.
I dress in an apotropaic way, as if to propitiate a sun god, and wore a Graham Greene ice cream concession Our Man in Havana suit.
Our Man in Havana.
In the hope that it wouldn't turn mud brown by noon, which it's in the process of doing.
And George, you've taken another option.
Well, as you can see, I pay great attention to my clothes, but I've actually got some industrial strength Dunlop Wellingtons on, which means that I'm probably the only well-prepared person in the entire Hay Festival.
You look, Naomi, you don't look like you really ought to be Hay at all compared to in terms of what you're dressed in.
I'm actually just wearing layers. I'm wearing my entire suitcase all at once.
Okay, now moving on to my first guest. Christopher Hitchens is a writer and journalist. He's a contributing editor of Vanity Fair, recently the subject of a cover story in Prospect magazine, which has also voted him one of the world's top 100 public intellectuals. And his latest book, God Is Not Great, has been an international bestseller. Christopher, were you surprised by just how well the book has done?
No, I wasn't, because I think, to borrow an old cliche from President Kennedy, rising tide sometimes really does lift all boats, and we'd already established from the success of Professor Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris that there was a real market for books attacking the supernatural and the superstitious, the parties of God and the hideous damage they're currently doing to civilization. And I think there's a mood, in other words, of fighting back, resistance to theocracy.
But were you surprised that it's entered the sort of the public conversation and people who might not necessarily buy books have been buying it?
No, I think the zeitgeist is exactly right for this now.
But what's interesting is that your book is not necessarily just about religion as such, is it? It's more as much as about how religion is practiced in public life, is that right?
Yes, it's about the way in which religion has let itself be politicised, yeah. But it's also an attack on the idea that faith is something that deserves respect, that the habit of, very strong in America, of privileging faith and saying, if someone can be called a man of faith, that's axiomatically a compliment. Needs to be challenged.
But you also
indeed needs to be ridiculed.
But you also argue that, I think one of your lines is, conscience is a good conscience is enough. You don't necessarily need the wrath of heaven behind it.
Well, I think it's positively immoral to suggest that we couldn't know the good. In other words, do a right action or say a right thing. Without a divine sanction, either an inducement or a threat, that is itself a very immoral view of our nature.
But where is the can morality?
Just as the idea that a vicarious redemption by human sacrifice, by murdering a scapegoat and throwing sins upon that person, is a primitive and evil thing to do. It's why Christianity is not just untrue and legendary and backward, but actually wicked.
One of the things I was quite surprised about when I was reading your book was there's actually quite a lot of humour in there. I thought it was going to be more of it is an angry book in some ways, but I think it had some pretty good gags in it as well. You were talking about how members of apocalyptic death cults must feel a persistent sense of anticlimax. Do you think that the best strategy against religion is reason and rationality, or do you think it's humour and absurdity?
Well, I think Voltaire demonstrated a long time ago, if I can mention my name in the same breath as his after your kind remarks, that irony and ridicule are very powerful allies of reason and rationality, and that one of the things he used to do in his attack on the papacy was to take the papacy's doctrines literally and then see where they would lead. I'm, for example, always in favor of saying, well, I've no doubt that Jesus was born of a virgin. I mean, every other god certainly was. And then I list all the virgin births that have ever been. I say, but the strange thing is, you'd have a virgin as your mother, apparently, and it wouldn't prove anything about the truth of your doctrines. All your work is still ahead of you.
I thought the other thing was, you mentioned that all the prophets seem to come from one particular part of the Middle East, and they all seem to be illiterate peasants, which
tends to be
strange coincidence.
The revelation of tends to people who can't read in Bronze Age parts of the Middle East. Yeah.
Right, more from Christopher later on. Now, Naomi Klein, my next guest, is a journalist, author, and filmmaker. Her first book, No Logo, was published in 2000, hailed as a manifesto for the anti-globalization movement, and her new book, The Shock Doctrine, argues that a systematic use of shock tactics by an alliance of politicians and economists have resulted in what you call disaster capitalism. Naomi Klein, what is disaster capitalism?
It is the harnessing of large-scale crises and disasters to push through unpopular policies. Any crisis is an opportunity, but I'm talking specifically about an anti-democratic strain, taking advantage of the chaos, the window of opportunity that opens up when people are frightened and focused on daily emergencies, to push through privatizations, deregulations, cut to government spending, the whole sort of neoliberal package. But I'm also talking about the fact that the final frontier for the privatization of the state is the core, the only thing that hasn't been privatized yet, which is government emergency services. So it becomes sort of layered, where you have the disaster pushing through privatizations like water, electricity, but then also you have Halliburton and Blackwater showing up in New Orleans, Blackwater saying, you know, we'll be the police, because this is the only thing that hasn't yet been sold. So disasters become an industry.
And the idea is that in the state of sort of trauma, when a society or a person is in a sort of a dizzied state of confusion, then it's at that point that you can make some change. But what I found was really interesting was that you draw a parallel between individual torture and how states behave, and you begin with some story of was it the Canadian Ewan Cameron, was it?
Yeah.
Who was like a fascinating story, and I thought that parallel was quite an interesting one, because it's more than just a metaphor, isn't it?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to be clear that this is not a tactic that is exclusively used by the right. The far left has used disasters and states of dislocation to push through their versions of utopias on blank slates cleared by disasters. But it is a very anti-democratic impulse, unlike an impulse to use a crisis like the crash of 1929 to bring more people into the political process. So I'm talking specifically about that blank slate, this imagining a crisis as a blank slate, and often God is invoked in these moments, which is interesting. One of my favorite quotes from the disaster capitalism complex is from Richard Baker, a Republican congressman in the state of Louisiana, who said of the public housing projects in New Orleans, we couldn't clean them out, but God did, after Katrina hit. But, you know, after reporting from Iraq on the attempt to impose shock therapy after the shock and awe invasion, and I was in Iraq when the first Abu Ghraib photographs emerged, I just wanted to understand what shock meant. I mean, it's this phrase we use the word, but I think we sometimes just use it to describe bad things. And so I was trying to figure out how I could understand it better. So I started reading psychological manuals and texts about post-traumatic stress. And I ended up reading the CIA's interrogation manuals, which describe the state in which you want a prisoner, to put a prisoner so that they are pliable, so that they give you what you want. And they describe the state of regression that opens up in a period of shock, and the window of opportunity, and taking advantage of that window of opportunity where we start to think that the interrogator is a father like figure. So I am drawing a parallel between that state of regression that is deliberately induced in the interrogation chamber and the state of regression that sets in when we are collectively in a state of shock and we start to think that Rudy Giuliani is our long lost daddy and he's going to take care of us, you know.
I am Will Self, and you are listening to the Grawniad Haycast.
That was Will Self, who spoke at an event yesterday. We'll be hearing from him later in the week, when he'll be talking to The Guardian's own John Crace about how, as a satirist, he feels about being satirised. But now to George Monbiot, who is a writer and environmentalist, and his latest book, Bring On the Apocalypse, is a collection of journalism and essays. One of the things I thought was interesting about it is that it's a collection from the past 6 years or so. Often journalism doesn't stand the test of time. And do you sometimes, was there a danger, the fact that it's not arranged chronologically in your own arguments or the relevance of any of the pieces? Is there a danger of putting what was, I guess, written as a journalistic piece in a book form?
Well, yes, there is that danger, and there were quite a few pieces, obviously, which couldn't go in because they were very time-dependent. But I chose pieces which did seem to stand up even now, though they were published some time ago. And, of course, one of the rather distressing things is to discover that as environmentalists and as anti-war activists, we've been proved right all too often. And it does seem to me very often that environmentalists are people who are wise before the event and often get tremendously abused as a result of taking a line which is different to that of most governments. And yet, especially in the past few years, turn out to be vindicated. And there's no pleasure in that. There's no satisfaction in that vindication. It's these are the events which vindicate us are the very events which we're trying to prevent.
You talk the book is sort of arranged as in a series of existential arguments. You might put. Do you remain optimistic about the idea of positivity? I mean, the book's obviously got an apocalyptic title, but in the sense of human nature, do you think you're running against the grain of human nature in terms of trying to encourage people to behave against their better interest?
Well, the title is ironic and refers to this death cult really built around certain parts of the Republican Party, which
is a lot of religion and God invoked.
Well, there is, and I'm sure that Christopher and I will find some common ground here. But there's this extraordinary bunch of religious conservatives who are actually trying to provoke Armageddon and bring about the rapture, which means that they, the blessed, will be wafted out of their pyjamas and the sky will be filled with floating nudists going up to sit at the right hand of God, while the rest of us, and this is where their real satisfaction comes in, get consumed by plagues of boils and locusts and frogs and the rest of it. What makes it so alarming is that for a while at least, they seem to have the ear of the presidency and a considerable amount of power in Washington. And in certain respects, US Middle East policy appeared to reflect some of their agenda. As for this question about human nature and pessimism, yes, I mean, we are an extraordinarily violent and destructive species, which seems to be peculiarly good at disturbing the conditions which suit our own advancement and our own prosperity. And a very good example at the moment, for instance, is the determination by most Western governments to prevent the beneficial effects of a high oil price from being felt by demanding that OPEC increases its the scale of its production so that we can go back to profligate use of petroleum for driving and for flying and the rest of it, just at the time when finally government's policies are being implemented by economics. And so I do constantly in this collection highlight that apparently self-destructive impulse.
Okay, we'll be hearing more from George, Christopher Hitchens and Naomi Klein. But first, last night I was on a panel for a debate on the American elections. The very fact that such a debate was being held and was so well attended is an indication of how the current American elections have captured the public imagination here in Britain. With me on the panel were the Spectator editor, Matthew D'Ancona, the Greenpeace director, John Sorvin, and Brecon and Radnor Assembly member, Kirsty Williams. After the event, I spoke to Jonathan Friedland, who chaired the event, about why people here felt so passionately about the American elections.
I think the lesson of the whole Bush presidency has been that the stakes are very high directly for people who live outside America and especially in Britain, because George W. Bush decided to go to war in Iraq and it was our soldiers who went. So we have learnt thoroughly that what they decide there, the person they choose there, absolutely will materially affect us. And that's why you saw that level of knowledge and discussion here in Hay about America, because people realise it's their politics too.
What I was particularly impressed by, apart from the contributions of everybody on the panel, of course, was the level of sophistication of the questioning.
I know. The audience were asking questions there that you absolutely would expect from a sort of town meeting debate somewhere in America. They were absolutely across every twist and turn of the story. You notice there are a few times panellists mention names where I thought, as chair, that I would need to explain who those people were. And I wasn't sure I did need to explain after a while. I think the audience knew who, that Bobby Jindal is the governor of Louisiana or whatever. I mean, maybe that's a more obscure example. But mainly, people were across what has happened in this campaign. And people have clearly been following it.
And do you think there's some lessons in Britain here? Because America is obviously doing something right here.
Well, I've always thought that we take a very sniffy attitude in Britain towards personality politics. We always say, oh, let's not talk about personalities, let's talk about policy. America, which is the home of personality politics, has a presidential system which is entirely about individuals seeking the highest office, and yet it flushes out huge political issues. I think personality is a brilliant vehicle for politics. It's how people actually understand politics. I once had a teacher say people don't believe in ideas, they believe in people who believe in ideas. And that is to the fore in a presidential election. Our system still pretends that isn't true and tries to keep it at some abstract level of policy and doesn't connect in the same way.
Also speaking yesterday was the revered American essayist and novelist Gore Vidal, whose visit to Britain was likened by his publisher to Zeus descending from Mount Olympus to drop in on the mortals. Among the mortals he dropped in on was Claire Armistead, who spoke to Gore Vidal this morning.
Say if Obama has won and he's moved into the White House, what does he have to do to make you proud of being an American?
Well, I don't go around looking all day long for reasons to be proud of the United States. Thus far, there haven't been any for 8 or 10 years. And reasons for shame are quite great, but, you know, shame is not an American emotion. We're told we're filled with laughing gas every day. It's the greatest nation in the world. Everybody envies us. All of our... We have 35 different detergents that you can go out and buy that will do the job of Rinso White. Well, you know, an addled electorate like that isn't going to do much of anything intelligent.
And that brings me to the next question, which is how much can one man do? Or one person do, a man or a woman, depending on who gets it? Are we unrealistic to think that a president could change anything?
Well, he certainly can't do anything about the economy. They all go on as if you get McCain for president, you know, he would be fatal. It's the most ignorant man since George W. Bush to run. And he confessed he didn't know anything about the economy. You've got to know something about it in order to make the country work. On the other hand, the president cannot affect it. It's done by big business. It's done by corporations. It's done by declaring wars. That's one thing. That brings a lot of revenue to the military.
So which of the three candidates would have best control, not, as you say, no control, but would have best knowledge of the economy?
Hillary. That's why I was for her from the beginning. No, she's a good student, and she's been sitting there boning up on the economy, and she's very good at it. Mm. And she's a good explainer, like her husband. That was part of his charm as president. He could explain anything to the dullest citizen, and did. So I think she would have been by far the best. She could still be given a cabinet post in which she could affect it.
Would she be a good vice president, do you think?
Oh, nobody's a good vice president, for heaven's sake.
Why is that?
They have no task other than waiting for the president to die, which I don't think is good for character.
So is there a cabinet post that would be better for her?
Yes. Treasury, maybe.
Which is a more important job?
Oh, of course it is.
What sort of a president do you think Senator John McCain would make?
Mr. Magoo. Well, you know, my boy, if you step too close to the abyss over there, you might fall. Oh, my goodness me. He fell. You know, I warn that boy time and again, don't put your foot over there. He's gone now. That's Mr. Magoo. He's blind. He doesn't know where he is at any given moment, and that is Senator McCain.
A bit like your impression of the present incumbent, then.
No, there's no impression of him. It's silly, you know. It's hard to even think of him pretending to be president.
Gore Vidal speaking to Claire Armistead. It's kind of obvious why so many people here have gotten excited, I guess, about the American elections. Christopher Hitchens, why do you think there is as much at stake as people are imagining there is?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact, because at stake is the whole question of whether America has or has not reached the point of describing itself as post-racial or post-ethnic. And I can tell you that until probably the primary in North Carolina, but possibly at the time of Pennsylvania, until then, millions of younger people were believing that they already lived in that world. And the effect of what I call Mrs. Clinton's adoption of a Southern strategy, in other words, of an explicit appeal.
Saying that I'm only the one who can appeal to white working class.
Yes, and that it's okay for them to feel and say that they don't trust the idea of a black Democrat, has been to make sure this is the most racialized election since George Wallace was a third party candidate. I don't think anyone has begun to estimate the damage done to them. I'll just say something old-fashioned, to the moral fibre of the country, right, by the unbelievable cynicism of Mrs. Clinton.
But do you think, what's interesting about your book is that you make quite a good play about the fact that actually who's in charge in the White House or in power doesn't necessarily massively change the relationship between corporatism at all. So do you think that, does it really matter who's in charge?
I think different politicians are more receptive to pressure than others, you know, and I think that's I don't believe that if Obama was elected he would rule so differently if left to his own devices. But you know, we have been dealing with an administration that prides itself on its complete deafness to political pressure. And you know, the quintessential moment recently is Dick Cheney being asked how he feels about the fact that 2/3 of the country are against the war, and he said so. And then there was this really uncomfortable pause. But that's basically been the attitude. So I do believe that that there are differences in receptivity to public pressure. I think some of these candidates would clearly be more receptive to others. I do think that there can be a different economic model if we demand one. And what I object to about this sort of obsession with the American elections is not that we're talking about it, but that we're talking about it in such a narrow way. And we are sort of treating it a little bit like a reality show. It's completely on the horse race. And I think it's disheartening that Obama just has super fans. I don't question people who
super delegates.
Yeah, and super delegates. But I have to say, I'm a little shocked to hear Gore Vidal endorse Hillary as Treasury Secretary, because certainly the privatization of the U.S. government began in full force under the Clinton administration. And the Bush administration has just taken these policies to their logical conclusion. I don't think that we would get a very different economic policy under Hillary Clinton. In fact, I know we wouldn't.
George.
I think that's a very interesting illustration of this question. When you look at climate change policy, and we all know that George Bush unsigned America's signature on the Kyoto Protocol and said, we're pulling out of this, we're not having anything to do with it. But he didn't do nearly as much harm to the global effort to fight climate change as Al Gore did. Because Al Gore wrecked the Kyoto Protocol for everyone. His lobbying in 1997 at Kyoto was what turned it into a completely ineffective instrument with very small targets, far too late, with these get-out clauses, a clean development mechanism and joint implementation, which were really just ways of preventing action from being taken in the industrialized countries. And he did so in turn because the Senate had already voted 95-0, the Democrats completely united with the Republicans, against a treaty of that kind. And when you look at campaign financing in the United States, it's not hard to see why that takes place. And the big energy companies and the transport companies and the automotive companies, they give very generously to all sides. There's hardly a senator, hardly a member of the House of Representatives, who has not been the recipient of lavish donations by those industries.
One of the things,
if I could just add one thing, yep. Hillary Clinton's gotten more money, has received more money from the weapons industry than John McCain.
I was going to say, one of the things that's interesting about all of your books and all of your arguments, in a sense, is that there is a sense about people power in this, isn't there? I mean, Christopher, you were talking about, in a sense, that you think that part of the reason the book's success is that it's caught a zeitgeist moment in terms of how some of the people are. Naima, your argument in some ways is if you can localize and organize and act and be active, then whoever's going to be in charge will have to be listening. And it's the same, I guess, with the environmental thing. But in terms of religion, for example, you can't imagine an American president who doesn't advertise their religious faith, can you? So do you think that people power you're talking about, will it trickle up in any way in terms of to diminish the role of religion in public life?
Very noticeable, though, that each one of the three candidates in this election has been savagely embarrassed by the religious friendships that they made when they thought that was the cool thing to be doing. You will know about the ridiculous shout and holler figure of Jeremiah Wright. Yesterday, I knew this would happen. Senator McCain had to disown both the Reverend Rod Parsley, a man who sounds to me like a P.G. Woodhouse character, but who believes that one of America's manifest destinies is to be the country that destroys the Muslim religion, and a man called the Reverend John Hagee, who thinks that the Vatican is the Antichrist and God brought the Holocaust to the Jews in order to bring about the State of Israel. So these two comments had to be disowned by an embarrassed McCain. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has set herself up with the people whose names you don't know. They're a very obscure group of people, rather cultish, rather zombie-like, rather sinister Christians who run something called the National Prayer Breakfast. My bet is in each case, these politicians have made a mistake. They think America is much less secular than really it is. The fastest growing minority in the United States, and it's something like 20% now already, and growing very rapidly, is those who have professed no faith.
But they don't have the organizational power, though, do they? By the way,
we vote and we have money too. And
But do you have the organizational muscle?
More and more. People don't lie. Even the religious know when they're being got at. They know that when a politician suddenly starts appearing with priests and nuns and so on, what they're trying to do is make a hypocritical appeal. And even the devout don't like hypocrisy. And good for them.
Do you think religion is a more malignant force than corporate power?
Well, in fact, I think we see them working hand in hand quite nicely, and they always have. This ability to invoke God to rationalize land grabs is it's a fine tradition. I quoted Richard Baker saying that the housing projects had been cleaned out by God. Well, you know, read the diaries of the Pilgrims who settled North America, and you know they'll tell you that smallpox came from God and it cleared their land for them, and it was a divine plague. So, in fact, you know, these are wonderful partners, and they're partners, they're partners in many ways, because the corporate state that is constructed is necessarily weak when it comes to social services, and so the state recedes from the functions that help education, healthcare, community centers, garbage collection. You know, for goodness sake, and what you see around the world, both in the United States I saw it in Iraq with the rise of Muqtada al-Sadr. You know, the U.S. occupation just does not reconstruct the country. They hand all the money to Halliburton and Bechtel, and in comes Sadr. And he organizes traffic control and garbage collection and so on. And the rise of the evangelicals in the United States, it's not simply this, but there are many communities where the church, particularly the mega church, is the only sort of pseudo-public space. There are no places to gather. So you go to the mega church and you get daycare and you get aerobics class and you talk about issues, you talk about politics. So these are, I think it's a false dichotomy to say, you know, we don't have to worry about economics because the great threat to a civilization is religion. In fact, we need to understand how these forces are intersecting.
There's a really interesting quote in your book about you try and peel away the onion. It's the idea of trying to create a blank slate, and you try and peel away the onion to try and get to the end, and then realize that the onion, the layers, are all you have. Yeah. So that seems to be a sort of a parallel, actually, in the sense of stripping away, trying to start again, and actually the core is already is the process of
the
layers.
This is the Bible. This is the apocalypse. This is what we're all talking about in a way. It's like we don't like the current world, so we'll just blast it away, and a great boat will save us, or we'll be airlifted to the sky.
I'm Juan Gabriel Vasquez, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
The other thing which I thought was really interesting to ask you is, you all have followers in some senses, in terms of people who are going to be going to your core constituencies, who are going to read, I guess, the things you read, the things you write. Do you think that you actually change the minds or appeal to people beyond the people who would read you because they agree with you anyway? Christopher?
I do get an enormous amount of mail. And I can tell you without affectation, I hope without sounding boastful, that many, many people have told me that I've helped them get rid of their burden of belief. Presumably, these were people who were already wrestling. My role might only have been catalytic. But in some cases, people have said, I'd never thought about it that way before. I'll never be able to think about it that way again or any other way. And, you know, you've turned over all my luggage. That's a great compliment.
But you don't think that there's...
I get rude letters, too.
I'm sure you do. But is there a danger that people think they know what the Hitchens' take on something is going to be?
I would be very depressed if someone couldn't guess what my attitude to, say, theocracy or suicide bombing or female genital mutilation was in advance. I would feel I've wasted my life if people would find me utterly predictable on a thing like that.
And same question for you, Noam McLean. Do you think anybody who doesn't sort of agree with you anyway reads or listens to what you have to say?
I think we do try to bring some new ideas to the table. So even if there's a general inclination to agree, the hope is that you leave the experience of reading a book a little bit more energized, more focused, readier to win a debate with someone else. And I think when it comes to religion, this is really clear, where there's been such a sort of monopoly for the religious forces for so long that you had a silent majority that was feeling uncomfortable about it, but they vaguely shameful and not willing to get in there and feel forceful in their position. So it's not just about changing someone from one end of the spectrum to another, but it's also just about making your side a little stronger. I realize I'm describing preaching to the choir, but I actually think that's a little underrated.
do you think anyone's bought a bicycle and ditched their car because of anything you've written?
Mm-hmm. Some people claim to. I do know of someone who was working for Tesco and decided to cross to the other side as a result of something I'd written. No. But of course it happens. I'm often asked, why don't you write for the Daily Mail? And the reason is they won't have me. it's simple, really. If you're going to be a campaigning journalist, you have to have a forum which allows you to campaign and which allows you to build up a constituency and build up a body of work which you can then use to project those campaigning messages. And you can't do that if you're a left-winger working for the Daily Mail.
And on that bombshell, on that revelation, brings us to the end of today's Haycast. I'd like to thank my guests, Christopher Hitchens, Naomi Klein and George Monbiot. Claire Armistead will be here tomorrow with a Welsh-flavoured edition, and I mean that literally, as food will be consumed. Joining her in this House of Hay will be the poet and novelist Owen Shears, the writer Di Smith, and the singer-songwriter Fleur Davith, who will be performing some of her music. Until then, from a very wet hay, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.